One of my favorite things to do on the planet is to share stories about Swami. So I want to thank you folks for coming to give me the opportunity to do that. I feel like it occurred to me, no one in Ananda has ever met Master. But we kind of feel like we have. And a lot of the reason that we feel like we have, for me at least, is because of all the stories that Swami has told over all the decades. And now Asha has done the same thing on behalf of Swami. She tells all these stories of Swami, and even new people or people who never had much time with him can really feel like you get to know him that way. So I feel like those of us who have spent some time with him really have that obligation. And Swami, of course, has done a magnificent job of sharing Master's vibration. But everyone's a little different. And I remember in 1993 at the Village, it was Master's 100th birthday. So we had a huge celebration. We invited Master's direct disciples from around the country. So Bob Raymer was there, and Peggy Dietz, and Roy Eugene Davis was there. And I was struck, in part, because every one of them told a different story that I'd never heard before, because they had their own experiences. So it was partially that, and partially also their experience was filtered through their consciousness. So it was a slightly different take on Master. They all felt true, but it was a slightly different take because it was coming through them. So again, I feel like those of us who have been around have some obligation and blessing, of course, but also it's good to share these different stories of Swami because it will help people both understand him and tune into his consciousness and to keep that vibration as alive as possible. So that's part of where this all came from. It felt like now was the time to do that. And selfishly, I have to say that I couldn't wait to hear all of Lahari's stories. So, because I know mine, but I don't know hers. I think the way that we'll do this, I'm going to speak a few minutes at the beginning, then Lahari will speak to introduce also. And then at least what we decided initially, and we'll see how it goes, is I'll do most of the first night, and then she'll do most of next Thursday. But I really want to build this together. This is not like this thing that we've done a lot of, and we have it all worked out. So if people have thoughts, drop me emails or even during the class. And in part two, it would be great if people participate as much as possible. I don't want to just, let me finish just this thought, I'll come right back to you. I don't want to just share all these stories and that's that. Just last week, I was having dinner with a friend and I mentioned some experience I've had with Swami. And he said something, a way to look at that had never occurred to me before in 30 years. Now that was great. And I really appreciated hearing it. So I'll say that you folks, too, don't be shy. I mean, as things occur to you or other ways to look at things, you know, we're all in this together and we're just trying to keep that flame burning as brightly as possible.
I was wondering if we could sit in a circle. It would make it, instead of more like a classroom, it would be more, you know, we're looking at each other.
It'd be harder for the speaker.
It's harder for me because I like to be able to see people's faces. When I'm speaking, sometimes I'll see a facial expression that will give me a hit on what I should say in response. But if we're in a circle, I'll be doing this.
Yeah, I can see really people's faces, too.
Well,
you can sit with them.
Yeah, you can sit up here. Actually, I'm fine. Sure, you can sit here. I mean, whatever you prefer. But I've tried that when I do my other teaching outside of Ananda, and it's a little awkward. Because when I see people, if people start going, I know I've gone on too long, for example. So so I want to be able to see the faces. But you are certainly welcome to be up here if you like.
Yeah.
And you can see people. I'm certainly fine with that.
You can all see me.
Lahari, did you have a little bit you wanted to say?
Oh, yeah. Well, I just second the thank you guys for coming, for showing up. We started with Sarah in the room, and it would have been fine if nobody else came, but it's always nice when you have a few more people. And I've been realizing, you know, as I get a little bit older, some of the things might start slipping away from the memory banks. So I've been trying to capture some of the more important things. My relationship with Swamiji was not that much about words. And so I only had really few words from him. But those words have been like real guideposts for my life. And they have come in so handy. I would use the same phrase hundreds of times in the last years. And I thought, if they work for me in so many different circumstances, maybe they could work for somebody else sometimes. So just to share with that idea. And also, as David said, to keep it alive. You know, you don't have to have been in the same room with Swami, to have had experiences of Swami, and I'd love to see this grow. I'd love to see satsangs happen where, you know, many, many people are in the room, say, you know, Swami, I read this in Swami's book, and that happened for me. Because he's in our lineage of these great masters now, attaining freedom in his life. So what he uttered and what he lived and the examples that so many eyes have seen and witnessed, they are so close to us. You know, he's from our own generation, just a little above. He walked at the same time we walked. And whereas Master we know through books and through Swamiji, thank goodness, Swamiji is even a little closer for us to tune in. So we all want that consciousness that Swamiji attained, and looking at his life and meditating on things he said, having other people share, I think is one of the ways that helps, it certainly helps me keep on the path and feel encouraged and inspired. So I'm really glad we're doing this. So thank you, David.
Sure. And of course, Swami's belongs to the purest pipeline we know to master.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I was trying to, as I said, I didn't want to just like list a lot of stories. So I was trying to figure out a way, something to hang it on, so to speak. And I came up with categories, different categories, and then stories that relate to those categories. So I'll start by just sharing a few, and we'll see where it goes. It's been a long time. Karen and I moved to the village in 1983, so we were with Swami for about 30 years. And he was a little more active in those days. So he didn't just assign projects, he would get involved in the projects. And so you got to mix it up. And as Swami said, every word that Master ever said to Swami, he would really think about it, really, even just hello. I mean, was there a meaning to it? Was there something special? Master himself said, no one ever, anywhere on the planet, crossed Master's path without a reason. And so I tried always to carry that attitude with Swami. And there are a few stories in here you'll hear over the next few weeks. Little things he said to me that seemed so innocent, and I couldn't get them out of my head. And I thought, I bet that means something. You know. So again, if any of you have any insights to share, please do. I do not think there is a 0% chance that I exhausted the possibilities that these stories bring. So if you have anything to contribute, I would be greatly appreciated to hear it. The first category, and I think as Lahari said, everyone has different relationships with Swami. For me, what I was always open for was a lesson. My take very much on the path, and we're all different, but my take on the path is, on some level, our pain comes to us, the difficulties we feel, because we have a wrong attitude about something. And I don't mean a bad attitude, but just there's something that's caught in our consciousness. Because, of course, God is perfect. So if we were really living in that, nothing would ever bother us. But things do. So for me, my relationship with Swami in part were these little correctives that would happen. And you'll see as I go through them, he was always very sweet. I was fortunate in that way. I mean, on occasion people would get blasted. I did not have that experience, which I'm grateful for. But whatever he wanted to do to me, of course, was fine as well. But these little things that would exchange. So this first part is just lessons. And I'll start with one that was very early for me, that went on for years. It's hard to believe, but I don't think he plans these things. I think he does what Master wants him to do. And this was a multi-year setup of me to be able to drive a point home after 2 years. I'm a big tease, and all of you in here are friends of mine and know that. I like to tease about things. It's one of my ways of attempting, at least, humor. But I wasn't as careful in my teasing in my early days when I got to Ananda. So I was never harsh, but I would say something, for example, that the other person might really believe. And then I would say, oh, I'm just kidding, and they would feel a little silly for having believed me. Now, Swami saw this tendency in me. I'll give an example. When Swami originally wrote the oratorio, he wrote the oratorio, and he shot many slides and photographs. So he wrote the oratorio, and he also took his slides of the Holy Land and incorporated them into the music. And in the early days, we had people going around the country booking and showing the oratorio in churches, and they would play the music, and they would show the slides. Okay. Karen, you've probably noticed, has her skin, she could be almost any ethnicity. When we went to India, people thought she was Indian. People think she's Spanish sometimes. Her parents are as white as the walls in this room. But somehow Karen has this cast on her, and she can look a little Israeli. We are both Jewish, and she has this dark hair. So Swami wanted a photo of an Israeli woman for this slideshow with the oratorio. Excuse me. Okay, so we asked Karen to come over to the dome in those days, to the dome, so he could shoot her picture. And he wrapped her in a blue and white scarf, like the Israeli flag colors, you know. And she really looked Israeli. It was really well done. She had this sort of shawl around her head, and he shot the photo, and it was all set. Then we left. And then a couple, maybe a week later or 2 weeks later, we were at the Hermitage, and he was talking about the oratorio, and he said, "Oh, Karen, I have to tell you, we decided to leave that photo out of the oratorio." And my response was, "Oh, that's so sad. I already sent press releases to the New York Times." Now, see, now you laugh. Swami just looked at me and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You'll have to retract it." And I felt, but I wasn't really getting the point. I'll tell just that one. My way is to tease, and I would tease. And every time I teased, he took me completely straightforward, and I still didn't get the lesson. Okay. It's like a year and a half later. I'm at the Hermitage, and he's there. We're walking down the hall, and we walk past this gorgeous rose bush, or plant, that someone had given him a few cut roses, I suppose. And I bent over, and I smelled it, and it was the most fragrant flower smell I had ever smelled in my life. And I don't know if it's because it spent all day in his presence or not, but it was extraordinary. And I said to him, "Sir, I've smelled roses before, but this is amazing." And he said, "Oh, we have a special spray that we use to enhance the scent." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Don't be absurd. Who would do such a thing?" And he walked away. And I thought, "Ah, now I see." A year and a half he'd been setting me up for that. But he cured me. I mean, I still like to tease, but I'm much, much more careful now about making sure that the other person isn't going to believe it and then feel foolish like I did. So, that was a fun one.
I will watch for that in your teasings of me.
Well, if it's a bad tease, you should stick it to me. Just go like this, and I'll picture Swami doing that. Another lesson. This was a powerful one. I'd worked on a number of projects with Swami, and whenever I was with Swami, I tried not to draw on him. I wanted to give him energy. It just didn't feel right. I mean, I don't know. I think you understand what I mean. I mean, just didn't want to. It felt selfish or greedy, frankly, and I just wanted to give him energy. But at a certain point, I had a nice relationship with him, and it pleased me. It just occurred to me, gee, that's nice. I have a nice relationship with Swami. Isn't that nice? The next time I saw him, he looked through me like I wasn't there. He didn't say hello. He just looked right through me. I said, "Hello, sir," like I always do. And he would always say, "David, good to see you." Walked right past him. I hadn't said a word. I hadn't seen him since this incident. No, I hadn't told anyone. It's like someone told him. It was extraordinary. It was extraordinary. Boy.
Did you connect it right away?
Oh, instantly. I'm going to get a little emotional during some of these stories. I hope you'll forgive me. It was really extraordinary. And I really worked on it. I mean, I knew it was just wrong. You know, to have ego pride over something like that is disgusting. And I really worked on it. And 3 days later, I saw him. "David, how are you? It's so good to see you." Wow. It was remarkable. Wow. Isn't that something? He just, I don't know, somehow he knew. So,
do you think it was just that he was trying to teach you the lesson of don't be proud of this friendship or family?
How did he know, though?
Or was it because
It's a good question. I'll tell you what I've come to, and this is just my personal opinion. I think the vast majority of the time when something like that happened, Swami didn't know. I don't think he was trying to do anything. He does what Master tells him to do. And you ever have the experience like you kind of walk into a room and you just sort of feel like, I don't think I belong here. You know what I mean? I mean, the room's not dark, it's not ugly, but there's just something. I think he just lived his life that way. He was just constantly trying to feel, what am I supposed to do next? What does God want me to do? What does Master want me to do? And I don't think it was conscious, But he just felt like he wasn't supposed to give me energy. Any more than if I was cooking, I would stick my hand in the soup. You just don't do that. You know,
so he didn't think about it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, sometimes I felt like he did.
Yeah,
but rarely.
Basically.
Rarely. You know, so often things would come up. I mean, I'll share more stories like that where I felt like he was just in the moment. And I said hello, and it's like he didn't even hear me. Yeah, it was so interesting. See, this is the kind of thing where you plug one into these things over decades. This was 20, 25 years ago. And you just, every nuance. You know, I mean, Asha was struck just, what, a week or two ago? She said there was some in discussion she had with Swami, and a new thing just occurred to her after 35 years. So, you know, and again, thank you all. It's so valuable for me to be able to share these things and, you know, swoosh them around in your mouth, as they say.
I have a tiny little example that touches on this, if it's appropriate.
Sure.
It has to do with the first time Swami ever said a word to me. And this was in the late 79 or early 80s when Swami was putting a lot of energy into coming into San Francisco. And this time he was giving a regular series of satsangs at the Unitarian Church in San Francisco on Gough Street, I guess it was. And I was going over there, I was just totally enamored of the whole thing. And the beginning of one of the early ones, he asked if anybody had any questions about what we've been talking about, meditation or something. And what I was doing, but I was not aware that I was doing this, I was trying to fish for some praise from him.
Hmm.
And I really didn't think so. But so I asked the question. I said, you know, I have when I meditate, I have this little feeling of pressure up here at the point between the eyebrows. I wonder if that means anything. And all I wanted him to do is say, oh, boy, that's pretty hot stuff. But what he said, he snapped at me. And he said, that's a terribly inappropriate question. And just shut me right up.
Wow.
The first word he ever said to me.
You never forgot.
No, I had not.
But I learned a lesson.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Very
nice. Of course, he saw right through it. It was pathetic. In retrospect, what I was doing was so juvenile and so inappropriate that he just nailed it. He wasn't going to miss words.
Yeah, because everything he did was so individual. You know, and I learned to completely trust him over the years. He could do these things that looked so bizarre, but I know he was feeling a karmic wrinkle in that person's consciousness. Mm-hmm. The first words he ever spoke to Jaya, one of our community family members, Jaya was over at the Dome, and I believe it's the first word he ever said to Jaya. He said, "Did you borrow my book?" Nice. But isn't that fun? Did you return it? I think so, sir. Okay. I mean, it's like, what? But, you know, if Master tells you to, your answer is yes, sir. Because we don't know. You know, you can't unpackage human consciousness by figuring it all out. So it's the grace of having someone like
that. So he would tune into what Master knows right at the moment.
Right there. And he just lived that way. But it has to be 24/7. That was the greatest lesson for me. You can't figure these things out. You can't get it that way. It's why psychotherapy works on a very specific thing, but it's not a way to build a consciousness. So. Oh, this one also was a long time. People, I think, probably know, I have a strong financial background. I've analyzed financial markets and all that sort of stuff. It's just what I've done, my gosh, way too long. Way too long. I'm going on over 40 years of that. And Swami had passing interest in that topic, especially because he was often talking about, you know, coming earth changes and disastrous financial things and all that. So every once in a while, I'd be in some small group, not at a big satsang, but there's 6 or 8 people or something, and something would come up, and he'd start talking about what was just about to happen, and then he'd stare at it, because he knew that I didn't think it was about to happen. Actually, just as a little aside, a year or two before he passed from us, I wrote to him and I said, I can see the seeds of what you've been talking about now for the first time.
You mean like in the financial market?
Yes, that things could in fact become very difficult.
Oh.
I had always resisted him on that point in the past. I mean, I said, look, sir, what do I know? All I can say is I've been studying this my whole life and I don't see anything in the financial markets indicating what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he would talk about what's about to happen, how the market's about to crash and all this, and then he would stare at me. Wait it, you know, it's like this. So I'd say something. I'd say, well, sir, you know, he wouldn't just stare. So he'd look at me and say, what do you think, Dave? And he knew darn well what I thought, because we'd done this 14 times over the last year. But, you know, what do you think? And I would say, well, sir, I mean, it was so uncomfortable. I didn't want to argue with him. I said, sir, I don't really see it. Need a run and look the other way. Okay, so this has been going on for decades. So we're in Italy. Karen and I are with the Ananda Singers in Italy. And he had us over to his house for tea, so the whole singing group is there. And he starts talking about financial stuff, and then he sort of looks at me. And he says, what do you think? And somehow I just got the cosmic joke of the whole thing. And I looked at him with a big grin on my face, and I said, you're baiting me, aren't you, sir? And he kind of gave it like a little, he went, like that, and he changed the subject. And then about 3 minutes later, he went back to the financial stuff, looking right at me. The market, and he said, I said, you're baiting me again, sir, aren't you? And he said, yeah, I don't know if I even believe that stuff myself. And then he talked about something else. The whole reason that he was doing that in front of me was to see if he could get a rise out of me. There's a crack in the pot. Because this was an important topic to me. And he would kind of go like this right in front of me and see if I would rise to the bait. And this went on for about 20 years. And then finally, at some point, I got that it's just a fact about the world and it's not important. He didn't mind discussing it. What he minded was that it would push a button in me. And I felt an obligation to
relate to it.
In sort of a way with some energy to it. I mean, I was always, of course, kind and polite to him. I don't mean that. But there was something in my spine about it. And right then, I was able to pop outside of it and see the cosmic joke of the whole thing. And I just laughed with it.
Oh, because you had been taking it too seriously.
Yeah, basically. Too seriously is one way to put it. But I had a karmic hook. And if we're going to be free, we have to be free. Yeah. And he could smell it in me. So he would just kind of egg me on.
Yeah.
And then watch me get uncomfortable and kind of like this. And then argue back with me and watch me get uncomfortable. And then then it never came up again. Never came up again. I wrote him one letter once. He had mentioned something at an SRW about the financial markets or something, and I wrote a letter and I said, well, you know, there's this other perspective. And he said, you know, you're probably right. You're better at this stuff than I am. It was over. 20 years.
Wow.
And one of the things for me that's so incredibly touching about that is the length to which Swami would go to save our souls.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about people are more important than things. I would watch Swami put someone in charge of an important, to the extent that things are, an important Ananda project at the village, knowing full well, that there was no way that that person could pull that off. And Swami, which meant Swami knew too. But Swami would put the person in there because it was the right thing for his soul. And when you see someone doing that, I knew that he would do that for me. And my feeling is that's what built such incredible loyalty to him and to each other at the village and now in the colonies. Because I watched him sacrifice enormous things, very substantial amounts of money, huge amounts of time, because it was right for that person to do that thing. And then he would back them. And very much the leadership, my best sense of the leadership at the village was the idea was you back the person or you remove them. If you think they can't do it, you pull them out. But while they're in there, you have to back them completely. Because that's really what makes it all work. And if you decide they're not, then you can remove them. But you can't undercut people. So he would put people in and he would really support them, and it was very difficult often for the rest of us. There was a fellow who's no longer in Ananda who was responsible for the Italian colony for a couple of years. Totally ill-suited. And it was horrendous for they weren't light bearers at the time, but the senior ministers and such who were living there. But Swami really backed this person completely. And I know he was trying to save that guy's soul, and it didn't work, and the guy finally left Ananda. It's to no good.
Yeah.
How was it supposed to help that guy?
He had a chance to break the right way. He was in a very difficult situation. The beautiful scene in the Mahabharata, when Yudhisthira goes back to play dice again, all right, knowing that he's going to be cheated. And his comment was basically, I have to give my enemies one more chance at redeeming themselves by playing honestly, knowing he was going to be. So I've seen Swami do this. He'll put someone in and it's a life raft for that person, knowing that there's only a 5% chance they'll get it right. But there's 5, and it's better than 0. And we're here for our souls. We're not here for the project.
And the other people that were involved, they were supposed to learn something too.
Apparently. Master's pretty smart. He can kind of work it out that everything works. You know, you have all your chess pieces working with each other, so it kind of works out in the end. But you see those things, and it's really painful. You know, and there was a feeling sometimes that, well, but leadership didn't know. Maybe they don't know what's going on. And I remember at one point I was working, when Vidura was Ananda general manager worldwide, I was working for Vidura, and things would come up, and Karen would say to me, you've got to tell Vidura. Oh, honey, he knows. No, you've got to. And I would tell him, because I know. Because we're just trying to get the whole thing to work. And Swami could see what your soul needed. And through stories like this, I really knew, I know it was true. Another story I'll share along those lines. I was going through a very difficult time. I found out later astrologically, which usually is the case if you're really feeling particularly heavy. And Swami knew it. And that's when he sent me and Karen to Italy. And when Karen and I went to Italy to sing for this, with the singing group, actually, as an aside, this also was really cute. There was some event at the Hermitage. I don't remember exactly what it was, but some big event at the Hermitage. So there were a lot of people there. There must have been 150 people there or something. Maybe it was his birthday weekend many years ago. And Swami was on the porch, you know, the porch right next to the house, sort of overlooking the pool. And there's a ridge there. So he's sitting on this little low wall, and he's sitting there. And he's sort of looking. He's sort of scanning everybody, and you can see it. He's sort of, it's almost like he's peering. I don't know if Swami ever peered, but it looked like he was peering. He's sort of looking. And there was this force field around him. It was the darkest thing. Usually people want to be near him. You know, it's like, you know, just sit near him or say hello. There was about a 10-foot-wide force field around him, and no one would go near him. So people would like walk towards him, and then they would sort of skirt the force field around the outside because he was peering, and you didn't know what it was, but you didn't want to be part of it. Well, Karen apparently got maybe 8 inches too close, and he said, Karen, come here. So she comes over. He didn't even know. He said, does David sing? And Karen said, yes, sir, he's in an ensemble here at the village. Good, I'd like you to move to Italy.
Wow.
That's what it was.
Wow.
This isn't a Swami story per se, but just as an aside, because this is so cute. I don't know if people know Ganesha lives up at the village. He's been there forever. He also worked for the Air Force. And he had an opportunity to move to Italy to work for the U.S. Air Force in Italy, outside of Venice. And he was telling me about this. So he and I, we're old friends, so we're just chatting. He said, what do you think? And I said, you know, Ganesha, when these things come up, what a life experience. When these things come up, you just have to say yes, don't you? At that moment, Karen taps me on the shoulder and says, Swami wants us to move to Italy. And I turned to Ganesha and I said, could you please repeat back to me what I just said?
She had not wanted to go initially.
It turned out to be truly one of the great blessings in my life. Swami said to me, it was just my karma. I'd always been responsible for things at the village. I had my own business up there, but I'd run a bunch of departments and just all kinds of things. Especially when I first moved to the village, hopefully I'm a little better now. I've always had a lot of energy, and I've always been plenty intense. But I was not aware of how my energy affected other people. So it would slosh out all over the place. But Vidura said to me at one point, many years later, he said, you know, when I put you in charge of a project, I never wondered whether the project would work. My hope was there would be some people left alive when you were done with the project. Fair enough. So Swami sent me to Italy with the following instructions. I don't want you to do anything. I don't want you to market the singers. I don't want you to help with the finances of the singers. I don't want you to think about managing the singers. You're going, I want you to love, and I want you to sing, period. It was really hard. Because when I first got there, I mean, it's just how my mind works. I could see all these things happening that should be a little different. I mean, if we want the project to work, we should be doing this instead of this. And I buttoned my lip, but the first 6 months, my tongue was so callous from biting it, I thought I was going to die. Then the next 6 months, I kind of started to get it. And then the last 6 months, I tried to take the attitude, whenever there was any energy around me in any form that was disharmonious, it was my responsibility. It was my fault, if I can use that word, but you know what I mean. So I did nothing but watch my consciousness. Not nothing. I mean, I tried. That was my... But I really started to get it, and I started to be much more aware of my energy and how it affected the people around me, which was a huge lesson for me. And I had to be taken out of my normal reality. Well, kind of like you said, Amajoti, when you went to New Zealand and then saw these habits, I needed to be taken out and given that as an assignment. So I was doing nothing but singing Swami's music 5 hours a day in rehearsal. And I had no responsibility for anything. I couldn't even get online. And it was really, and, you know, my gratitude to him for having sent me there is just hard to express.
I got your mail for you at the time you were doing
That's right. I needed someone to get my mail and help, because we still had stuff back here.
I didn't know what you were going through.
Well, I wasn't sharing at the time, but it was a dark time.
Interesting.
And he knew. And he pulled me out. I mean, I'm pretty sure Ash expressed it to him. But for him to just do that, I mean, it was just incredibly, incredibly
strange. Well, you could have said no, but you didn't.
Well, I couldn't say no. I never once said no to anything that Swami ever asked me to do. It just wouldn't.
Want to share what he said to you later, after you'd been there for a while?
Oh, well, sure. It's fine. I was in Italy. I've been in Italy for about 8 months, maybe, something like that. And we all went out to dinner. It was 15-20 people or so. And we were walking out of the restaurant, and he turned to me, and he patted me on the cheek with the most beautiful smile, and he said, "You're getting sweeter already." So, I mean, perhaps I only had one direction to go, I don't know. But I was grateful for the comment.
Did you also have... like a karmic lesson that she needed to go to Italy for, or she was just more along for
running? Not as clear. I mean, I have a couple of stories with her that I will tell, but it wasn't as clear. I mean, I really, you know, when you're a couple and as close as we are, sometimes I feel, I mean, of course there were lessons. Sometimes I feel like it was mostly mine or mostly hers, and one of us is along for the ride. I needed to do this. This was a big deal for me. It was a watershed moment. I mean, I was imploding. So... you know, it was an incredible thing.
But just knowing about, because I was getting your mail and stuff, so you were able to go away from your business and do that. That's remarkable. Like you could, you know, you things
well,
work
you just,
out.
You just do it. You know, I mean, you go to a doctor and you have a pain in your foot, and the doctor says, "Pat the top of your head," and you say, "Huh?" That's pat the top of your head. And you go, "All right, doesn't cost anything." So you do that, and your pain goes away. You think, "Well, that's weird." 2 weeks later. Now you have a pain in your shoulder. The doctor says, "Scratch your leg." You say, "What?" You get 40 of these in a row. When the doctor says something, you say, "Okay." Every single thing Swami ever asked me to do had an incredible blessing. Everything. So by the 15th one, you say, "Yes." I have no idea how. You know, I don't know why. I mean, I'll share one sort of along those lines. We were, when many years ago, Swami did what are called the Whole Life Expos. Now I think they're called the New Life Expos. I think they may still exist. And he would be, he was the keynote speaker for the one in Los Angeles. But he would do them in different places. And he was doing the one in New York. So we're in New York in the booth. And the booth was, Padma was there, I was there, Lisa Powers was there, I think, Karen, of course. A few people in the booth. Maybe Nishala and Nakula, I don't remember. And Swami is going to be speaking. He wasn't keynote in New York, but he's going to be speaking. And he hands me this stack of flyers and says, "Go out in the aisle." I think I told this story once to our satsang group. "Go out in the aisle and pass out these flyers." And you know, I mean, I didn't want to impose on people and all of that. I mean, you kind of, you feel all this reluctance, but Swami asked me to. So, yes, sir, I would love to hand out those flyers. Right? So I grabbed the stack of flyers. And you know how, you know when you're really sleepy and each eyelid feels like it weighs 50 pounds? Each foot weighed 200 pounds. And I'm sort of walking towards the aisle, and I really don't want to stand in the aisle to accost these poor people. And I've got these stack of flyers. So I finally get in the aisle. Okay. So I grab a flyer, and this woman walks past, and I say, excuse me, I wanted to let you know, Swami Kriyananda speaking tomorrow. I hand her the flyer, and she says, he is? Oh, I'm so glad you told me. I've been wanting to hear him speak for 5 years.
Wow.
And I thought, that's cool. All right. Good. So I'm ready to, like, retire. You're supposed to retire at the top, but I got this big stack of flyers. So I grab another flyer, and someone walks by. Swami Kriyananda is speaking tomorrow, and he goes, oh, that's great. Thank you so much. I can't wait to hear him. And I thought, wow, now I'm getting into it. Right? This is great. So I hand out the next one, and a guard comes over and says, you can't hand these out. You've got to hand it out for me, Lou. And that was it. I handed out two flyers. But I got it. I got the lesson. You don't even know what you're doing. You're an idiot. If you think you like it or don't like it, you have no idea what's going on. Just relax. Put your arrogance on the shelf. Mm-hmm. But it was, I mean, can you imagine?
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was so weird. And then I come back. So I'm back in the booth, and Swami's out doing stuff. And then he comes back to the booth. And he looks at me and he says, I thought you were handing out flyers. I said, oh, the guard said I'm not supposed to do that. And he said, oh, okay. And he left. He didn't care. It's not about the flyers.
Yeah.
Right? It's never about the flyers. One other lesson, in the booth, same show. Swami's leaving from New York, and it makes sense. I mean, he'd gone Ananda Village, New York, and he was on his way to Italy. So it made sense to leave for Italy from New York. Swami loved gadgets, theoretically. I don't know, Master used to collect canes, right? Swami loved gadgets. It was Sony's 100th anniversary, I think. So Swami had this little tape recorder that was truly incredible. It was a little cassette tape recorder, but the sound was amazing. And he spent the whole show, it was this little tape recorder about that big, with headphones. And he'd go to everybody in the booth multiple times, and he'd put them on and say, listen to this, you got to hear this, you got to hear this. And you'd listen to him and say, that's great, sir. And then he'd go to the next person. Then he'd come back to you and say, it's still great, sir. You know. So he walks up to me, and it's this little thing, and it was expensive. I mean, this little thing was like $800 back then or something. No, it was very expensive. At the time, it was the premier technology. And it came in this hard case that was quite a bit bigger than the cassette recorder. I'm not sure exactly why. There was a lot of padding, and there was a place for the headphone thing and the adapter and all that stuff. Swami comes up to me and says, you know, I'm leaving for Italy right after this show here, and this case is so big. You don't think I need it. Do you think I need the case for the tape recorder? And I said, well, sir, you know, I mean, they stow your baggage, and it's a long trip, and the thing is so expensive, and you just got it. Probably, if you could, it probably would be good to use the case. And he went, okay. He walked away. 2 minutes later, he's back, and he says, David, I have a question for you. Do you think I need the case for this tape recorder? And I'm thinking, this is bad, what's going on? And I said, yes. You know, you don't know what to do at that point. I mean, the man is not unconscious. I said, I kind of think you probably do. I mean, I didn't know what to say. I said, again, I said, it's very expensive, and it's fragile, and they gave it to you in a case, probably, like, they think that would be good. And he goes, oh, and walked away. 2 minutes later, he's back. David, do you think I need the case now? I'm slow, but I'm alive. So I'm starting to get, he wants a different answer. So I said, well, you know, it's like, right, what do you do? So I said, nah, you don't need the case. And he goes, oh, great, I thought so. So I'm thinking, what happened? And I realized what happened was I wasn't tuning into him. I was answering his question factually.
Oh, yeah.
But I wasn't tuning into him. Remember, Asha's often made this point? truth with a small t, or fact. When someone comes up to you and says, don't you love my new hat? You don't want to lie, but you're supposed to say yes somehow, right? It's polite. He wasn't factually asking me. He didn't want to bring it, and I should have been able to tune into that fact, and he wanted support. Now, I don't think he wanted any of this stuff. I think he was actually teaching me a lesson that this is how I should treat human beings. Tune into where is the question coming from. People are not asking you a factual yes or no question. They're asking for support of some kind, possibly. Maybe it's facts, but maybe it's not. And he gave me three opportunities to tune into his reality. And it wasn't until the third one that I finally got that point. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. If on the other hand, he also doesn't want people just to be a yes person. So if you automatically just said whatever
exactly.
You think he wants you to say, that would not have been the right answer either.
Exactly. Because you have, see, if you're just a yes person, you're not free.
Yeah.
He wants us to be free. And if you're free, you're doing what's appropriate because you're tuning into the current reality. You're not free if you like saying yes because you hate conflict. If you hate conflict and like saying yes, you're not free. Mm-hmm. You're bound by habits. Mm-hmm. They could be socially productive habits. You know? I mean, I like doing a good job on stuff. So I work really hard to do a good job on stuff. To the extent I want to do a good job to reflect master, that's great. To the extent I want to do a good job because I hate doing a bad job, it's ego. Mm. So it's socially productive, in a sense, but it's still ego. So I needed to be free to tune into his consciousness. And I wasn't doing that. Mm. I was answering about the dumb tape recorder. Mm. And it's just a tape recorder. And so he gave me three opportunities. And I was grateful for that. Because he could have just walked away the first time and given up. But there was something in him, I suppose, that sort of thought, he might actually get this if I do this a few times. And I did. It was powerful. You know, you never forget these things. I mean, it was powerful. Mm-hmm. It was a powerful experience. Mm-hmm. Does this seem like an okay way to do this? Just share different stories and let what happens, happens? Oh, here's one where I completely got it wrong. And I took 10 years to figure out why I got this wrong. I never got it right in front of him. I mean, on this point. For some reason, I guess it was just our karma, there were a few things early on at the village where Karen and I just found ourselves in the middle of these things. Swami was writing the book, Crisis in Modern Thought. What's it? Out of the Labyrinth, I think it's called?
Yeah.
Out of the Labyrinth. He was writing, back then it was called Crisis in Modern Thought. And he sent copies of the manuscript to Jyotish and Devi and Asha and maybe Hari, I don't remember, some other person, some other friend, and me and Karen. And we'd been in the village like 8 months. So I didn't really understand what that was about, but I thought, you know, what an incredible blessing. And he said, please make your comments. You know, I'm going to make detailed comments. I really want to know what you think of this. And he said, ostensibly, I mean, he always had a cover story. I majored in philosophy. And he wanted this book to be able to be read in the universities. Mm-hmm. So that was the cover story, at least. But somehow it was to work out some kink in my consciousness. Anyway, so he sends me the manuscript. It wasn't as tight as a seminar paper in philosophy at Swarthmore College. I mean, it was a good book, but it just wasn't that. And so I had at it. And I had just come out of Swarthmore College, a very fine college, where we were trained as philosophers to tear apart each other's arguments. Someone in the class would present an argument and then everyone would go at it. And you were supposed to take it completely and personally. They weren't going after you, but you made this point and I'll show you where it's wrong. And I had just gotten to the village. So I wrote this very lengthy letter to Swami, basically dismantling his book.
Oh, boy.
So Swami, and then Karen made comments also. So Swami writes back, I thought, it's over, I'm moving to Venezuela and changing my name. Swami writes back, Karen's comments were good. Your comments, however, were awful.
Oh.
They would require me to completely rewrite the book. And I am not rewriting this book, and I am certainly not rewriting this book on your account. Love, Swami. And, you know, I was new, and I thought, I'm doomed. And that's it. It's all over. You know, I'll go move into the barn and
pack
your bags. Yeah, it's all over. And really, it took such a long time, and it was the same lesson. I was taking apart an argument. A person wrote that. There was no part of my consciousness that was concerned for the author. That's just totally inappropriate. It's never right. Now, he's a big boy. I don't think he was crushed, and he published the book and ignored all my comments. Good for him. But I really needed to. I needed to learn that lesson. And this tape recorder story happened, you know, 10, 15 years after that, when I was more open to it. I didn't really understand what happened there. I felt sandbagged. Like, he asked for comments, and I made, they were good comments, and now, you know, what I did was terrible. But it's always about the other person, everything I've ever seen him do. And we get so caught, it's why he sent me to Italy and said, I don't need you to do anything. Work on your consciousness. If God wanted to have that book work in the universities, bang, and they all work in the universities. God doesn't need us for that. God needs us to open our hearts and for love. And I didn't get it. I just didn't get it.
What would you have done? Or what would you have done? I would have
made the same arguments, but I would have been much more careful about taking them into account. For example, if you said something that was false, in my eyes, you said something that just wasn't true. You know, like it's snowing in Reno or something, and I just check the weather and I know it's not. I don't say, oh, you're incorrect. I mean, you are incorrect, but it's just not how you do it. I say, gee, are you sure? I kind of thought maybe it wasn't. See, now it's getting the point across. If you're open to hearing it, you'll hear it. If you're not opening to hear it, it's not my job to force you to hear it. When Swami would have a satsang, I experienced it. I saw it happen in front of me. There could be some quality in you that needed to change. But Swami didn't want to push it. So he would point out the quality in the person next to you, like you're sitting next to Sarah. Suppose I wanted to correct you on some personal quality. I might look at Sarah and correct her for that quality. Now you're sitting right there. If you're ready to hear it, you'll hear it. But if you don't want to hear it, you can say, glad I'm not Sarah. Right? Isn't that interesting? He used to do things like that all the time. People would be in a thing with him, and three people would leave with three completely different stories in mind of what it was that he was endorsing. And I'd be in there, and I'd think, that's not what he said. He just didn't say that. So he had a way of working with you, but if you wanted to hear it, it was there. Because it's not our place. Now, there are times with Swami, especially, see, I think all of these were lessons for us. There are times with Swami when I saw him incredibly forceful and direct with people. But it's when Master told him to. Many, in the very early years of the community, Shivani was responsible for the garden at the village. And at one point, gee, this is being recorded. I hope I have these stories right. Shivani, if you get this, I hope I'm right. Shivani, there were some people working in the garden, and especially in those early years, people were coming through the village, and they were pot smokers, and, you know, it was just a mess back then. People were working in the garden. They weren't really doing anything. They were just sort of hanging out and smelling the flowers. And Shivani had sort of had enough, and she went to Swami at one point and said, Swami, I'm really going to let those people have it. I mean, that can be right sometimes, can't it, to really let them have it? And Swami said, oh, yes, it can be right to do that to someone else. But you better be darn sure this is one of those times. And she got the point. There's no behavior that we're ruled out of. If Master wants you to really let someone have it, let him have it. That's Master's decision, not yours. But you better be darn sure it's his idea and not your ego dressed up to look like Master. So I've seen Swami be incredibly direct. But I think part of his incredible kindness in working with people was a lesson for us. To watch him so sensibly. One time I was in a satsang at the Hermitage, and there was a woman at the village who was fairly inarticulate. And on top of being inarticulate, she was kind of shy. But she really had this question she wanted to ask. She raised her hand, and Swami called on her. It wasn't a formal thing, but we were just all there, and she had something she wanted to ask. And Swami called on her, And she started to stammer out this question. And between her shyness and nervousness and not being that articulate, I had no idea what she was talking about. I don't think anybody had any idea what she was talking about. And Swami said, "Oh, what a wonderful question. Do you mean to ask?" And he stated this question, and I don't know how to put it. The way he stated it, the question was so exhilarated, was so uplifted, that I felt inspired by the question without having heard his answer yet. And she said, "Yeah, that's what I meant." Oh, it was so incredibly sweet.
So kind.
And at the same time, I mean, someone who's no longer at the Tamina, I saw him blast someone, and it's the only time I've ever thought in a group setting with Swami, thank God that's not me. I expected the guy to turn into a pillar of salt while he was scolding. So, you know, you do what Master wants you to do, period. That's the only priority. But I rarely saw him that strong with people.
But he thought it was appropriate, so he did.
He had my, whatever he wanted to do. He was so much more tuned into reality than I was. I felt ridiculous having an opinion as to what he should be doing. I mean, what do I know? Mm-hmm. You know? There's a story in I don't know what book it's in, but where the school, the Ananda school system had been started, and at one point, Nitai made some comment like, Swami sent me out with instructions to start the school and then wasn't really as involved. And Swami's point was, of course he was involved. He held the entire project up in his consciousness. Well, I had my own personal experience of that. Karen and I left the village to start Clarity Seminars, to move to Palo Alto specifically to start Clarity Seminars. I felt like that's what Master wanted us to do, so we did. It's very difficult. I mean, if you can imagine starting a public speaking business with, like, no credentials, and this is like a joke, and it's expensive down here. So it was very difficult. But we really were working at it, and it turned out well, and it was starting to work. And it was about, I don't know, it had been about 5 years. The first 2 years were horrific. And then it was really starting to work, and we could feel like this is really going to work. Swami, when we were at the village, of course, I checked with everyone. I wasn't going to just move to Palo Alto. I spoke to Jyotisha Devi and all these people, and I spoke to Swami. And he was totally non-committal. He just would not say, you know, great idea, you know, I'm all behind you on this, I'll pray for you, anything. Zero. Zero. And I never really understood it. So there are two parts of this story. We got down and we were really making it work, and finally it was working. I'd been down here about 5 years, and I finally figured out why he never said anything. It's because if he had said, this is a great project, I'd have done it for him. He didn't want me to do it for him. He wanted me to do it because I felt that Master wanted it. He wanted me to do it.
Personalize it.
He didn't want me to do it for him. If he had said, I'm so glad you're doing this, when times were tough, I wouldn't have had to go deep inside and make a connection with Master and ask Master whether I'm supposed to do this. I would say, Swami asked me to. I'm happy to cut off my legs, sir, no problem. But he didn't want me to do it because he wanted me to do it. He wanted me to do it because I found the strength to do it. At least this is my take on it. This is one of these where if somebody has a better idea, pipe up. But that is that's how I came there. Then, after 5 years, I got an email from a friend in Italy. We'd been to Italy a lot even before we moved for that singing adventure. And he said, hey, Swami talked about me during the satsang. And I said, really? So he sent me the tape. And in the middle of satsang, Swami said, he was talking about something slightly related, that we need to get the teachings out. And Swami said, and I'm very happy to report that my Clarity Seminars is doing very well in Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. And I thought, he's never even mentioned it to me. Isn't that sweet?
Mm-hmm. He watched and he knew.
Apparently.
What? He watched and he knew.
Apparently, he felt some connection to it. I don't think he used the word my that casually. Mm-hmm. He never looked at my shoes and said, those are my shoes. Yeah. But somehow he really felt it.
But also, my wasn't very important to him anyway.
No, it wasn't on that level.
Truth was more important.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the fact that he would... I mean, I never even knew it was in his consciousness. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he would say... Let's just say when I heard the tape, I was struck. I guess God is the door.
Yeah.
So it's just, again, these... Mm-hmm. And then you chew over these things for a long time. I mean, something that happened more recently. Remember when Swami was doing the tours around the country, or into all the colonies? I mean, he Sacramento, we put on a big thing from here. He went up to Portland. Karen and I flew around a little bit, so we went up to Portland. So we're in the Portland community. We stayed with Vajra and Pavan, I think. We're staying in the community, and Swami was walking around the community, so we thought, let's go out and say hi. So Karen and I walk out, and he's in the big driveway there, and he's just walking down. Karen walks in, sir, it's great to see you. And he says, oh, David, do you live in Portland now? And I said, no, I live in Palo Alto. I mean, he and Asha talked back in those days. He and Asha talked all the time. And I know that she would occasionally mention me or Karen, more Karen, because she does more stuff here. Mm-hmm. So he knew it. But that really stuck in my head. Mm-hmm. And for 6 months, Karen and I really considered moving to Portland. Mm-hmm. Just because, was he saying? Mm-hmm. Oh, do you live here now? And I couldn't get it out of my head. Mm-hmm. And it finally just felt like it wasn't what was trying to happen. I still don't know.
That's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially since David Eby is there now.
You know, the mind can get in, I can come up with a million things. And for our living, so to speak, it doesn't matter where we live, as long as we're near an airport. You know, we fly all over the country and we can leave in Portland. Mm-hmm. So it's not that, but just... And I actually mentioned it to Lachman, you know, who's an old friend. He said, good for you. When Swami said something like that, you really need to chew on those things. It was just that little sentence. Oh, you're living in Portland now? Hmm. No, you know I'm not. Anyway.
So the jury's still out on that one.
Well, the feeling has receded. Mm-hmm. I mean, I looked for signs and clues and spoke to a few people and just to try and, you know how it is. You feel something and then you move a little bit and you try and feel, is this what's trying to happen? Mm-hmm. But moving energy, as Swami always said, has its own intelligence. So you can't just sit and think about something. Move a little energy and see, is there resistance or doors opening kind of? And it just never really felt like what was trying to happen. But I still have not, it's been years now, I haven't been able to get out of my mind. Because everything he says is for a reason. Everything he says is for a reason.
Well, you find yourself moving to Portland in 15 years, you might think that.
Yeah. No, I mean, if the door opens, if something happens that feels appropriate, you know, so it's there. It didn't feel like it was time to act on it, but I don't take anything he says as casual conversation. There's no reason to take it as casual conversation. And especially when it's so peculiar. He knew I wasn't living in Portland. Asha would have mentioned it. He's known us for 30 years. It's not like he didn't know who we were.
It was curious.
Yeah, it was very curious. It was very curious.
Is he often like that way with other people too? He's like cryptic.
He says little things, you know.
That happened when I wrote him to say, should I go to Southern California? To L.A. at that point. And, you know, I mentioned that, and I said, I'd like to know what you think. I'm also involved in a CSA and da-da-da. Within 5 minutes, he wrote back, emailed back, because he doesn't always do that. He wrote back and said... What's a CSA? So I explained what it was, what we were doing, and that he had the original idea years before, because I heard him say when there weren't CSAs, you know. And so then I expected him to say, oh, forget that, just go to L.A. And he said, growing our own food is very important, which is something that was used to be my political, you know, we've got to grow our own food. And then he went on with three sentences about how important it is, and you know, you should have a suitable substitute, and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, but I would love to see you in L.A.
Oh.
So, also, it was right, totally right. Like this. And until just now, when you said he wanted you to make up your own mind, that was certainly what he and then he never said any more, you know, right?
And it's interesting because he would treat each person so differently. I mean, you and I, if I can speak for you, we gave our heart to Swami decades ago. So he wants us to find it. Other people, he would sometimes give very direct instructions. You know, you should do this because that's the only way they were going to do it. So he would do that. So it's totally, totally individual. Well, I want to move to one other sort of category. And I tried to do these things by category level and then we'll close. But it felt like a sweet one, just his incredible compassion. At one point, Karen and I were living in Italy, and it was very sweet. Swami said, I need to go to town to do some errands. Why don't you guys come with us? Come with me. And we said, oh, sir, of course, we would love to. So we drove in, and we get there, and of course, instantly Swami says, let's go for a cappuccino. That's just what you do there. So we go to his favorite bar. It took me a while to when I first started going there. A bar is a place where you get drinks, not liquor. So we went to his favorite bar. We're having a cappuccino. And I was just so happy to be with him. It was so sweet. And this man walks in, totally disheveled, ripped clothing, scraggly beard, clearly a beggar. And he had a cardboard box that was cut low, so it's almost like a tray, with a piece of string around his neck, and the front end of the box is against his belly, so the box is sticking out. So he's got some things in the box, and he's walking around. Okay. And he can barely speak. He spoke a little Italian. And my Italian is not bad, so I knew what he was saying. So would you like to buy anything? And my first thought, and it's a natural thought, I'm almost ashamed to say it, my first vibrational thought was go away. You smell. I'm here with my teacher. I'm just basking in this light. And I just, and it wasn't a harsh thought. I just didn't want it to be there. Mm-hmm. You know. Swami turns to him and starts looking through the stuff in the box. And there was a cone and one of those little battery-operated fan things that you hold right near your face. And there was a spritzer bottle with nothing in it. I don't know. And just a whole bunch of stuff, you know. I think there was a scissors in there. I mean, I don't know where the guy even found this stuff. And Swami's looking through and he says, well, that looks nice. And that looks nice. And he winds up buying three items for like €4. And I almost lost the table. To do that with such dignity, the guy's trying to do something. He's not begging. He's trying to hold on to the little amount of dignity that he had by trying to sell these things. And Swami wanted to support that. And I was just so moved by it. Just incredible. I'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. One other little story that I did share once somewhere here in some other context, but I just really feel to share. Just how I have a category of miracles also, and this is both. I mentioned before that whenever I was with Swami, I tried to give him energy. I didn't want to draw from him. Mm-hmm. He's giving so much to the world. My highest service is to support him, not just draw. But I was going through a little period. We were flying to Italy. He was there. No big coincidence. We wanted to see him too. So we're flying over to Italy, and I'm on the plane, and I had this thought. I miss him. I just miss him. You know, it wasn't really more than that. And I just missed seeing him. You know, I mean, I hold him in my heart all the time. It just, and it lasted for all of a minute. And then it passed. Well, we were flying into Rome, and we timed everything so that Swami was doing one of his big events in Rome. So, you know, it's this huge hall and a zillion people in there, 1,000 people or something. And he's in the hotel, and the hall is, you know, it's one of these conference hotels, so he's up in his room. Karen and I get to our room, and we don't know anything. I mean, we know he's in the same hotel. We booked there intentionally. So we get to our room, we're carrying, and you know, it's a long trip from California, we're carrying all these 70-pound bags. And we get the key in the door, and we open it, and we're both exhausted, and I get the bags. And I get it in the room, the bags barely hit the ground, and the phone rings. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's ridiculous. How could anybody even know we're here? It's Swami. Mm-hmm. It's actually someone, Swami asked someone to call us. And they said, Swami wants to see you. All right, great. So we try and look marginally human, at least, you know, throw a little water on the face and run upstairs. And he's got a suite, and there's about 20 people in there, let's say, something like that. So it wasn't a large group, but, you know, not a few. So we walk in, and we open the door from the background. It's so good to see you. And, you know, you do what you do, and we take seats in the farthest possible corner to make sure everyone else can stay close. So he says, no, you can't sit there. You sit right here. And he has us sit right in front of him for an hour. And he spends the whole satsang talking to us. How did he know? What do you say to that? Wow. 30 years, that's happened a total of once, where he would call me and ask me to sit in front of him. 30 years. And I can say that I had that feeling once in 30 years. I hadn't even put the bags down in my hotel room when the phone call came. What do you say to that?
Miracle.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I don't know what to categorize that. It is a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw him do things like that, you know, all the time. I mean, one of our very early days in Ananda, Karen and I had moved to the village. We knew we were staying. We wanted to check out some of the colonies, you know, so went to Sacramento. And then we went to San Francisco. And in those days, the colony was in San Francisco. It was the San Francisco House. It was this giant three-story house with a bunch of people in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we go in there. And it was an Ananda thing. And so everybody knows everybody. I mean, it's like, you know, if we were all together at some place and we're all kind of like this. And Karen was feeling, she's, I don't know if it's obvious, but she's a little shy. I mean, she's just, you know, so she's feeling a little left out. And she's sort of standing in the corner. And Swami's there, and everybody's clustered around Swami. And Karen's sort of standing way off in the corner. And she's not even really looking at the group. She's just feeling all sad. All of a sudden, tap on the shoulder. She turns around, Swami. And he gives her a hug. And she said she felt an electric shock. And Karen is not this way. Neither am I. I don't have experiences. She felt an electric shock from her foot all the way through to the top of her head. She said it was one of the most potent experiences of her whole life. You know, what do you say? So, it's a few minutes to nine. We're winging this whole thing. Do you have anything you want to share or add or wrap up or anything?
I would say if you guys in the room want to have a little homework for next week and just write down maybe something. You know, I've been blessed, part of this, been talking about this class for a while now, and so it's really forced me to write down some things, you know, because they come through my head, you know, at a moment when it helps me or somebody else, and it goes away again until the next time it helps me or somebody else, and it's just been like that. And now I'm thinking, no, I want them all in one place. So it's just been, you know, I just invite you to share with me in that blessing of just capturing some of the thoughts, the memories, the experiences you may have had around Swamiji. Music, books, glances, touching his feet, you know, energetic, anything that you have, it's just so fun to keep it alive and share it with them.
Yeah, you don't want to lose those things. You know, for 20 years, I would say to Lakshman, be sure you keep notes on all of your experiences with Swamiji. And he has piles and piles of notes. He may well have done it on his own too, but what I'm saying is, it was important to me. And I think what Lahari is saying is exactly right. Whatever experiences you've had, or even reading a book of his, where you felt his presence and had something powerful happen, forgetfulness is one of the great enemies on the path. And you don't want to lose those things, and your ego will come in and the cloud descends and we don't remember, and it's so important to remember those things. They're really a life raft. So I strongly endorse what you're saying. Please, tonight, just spend 10 minutes and just think about things where you felt his presence or experiences you may have had, if you've met him, anything like that. It really is important.
Sure, of course. And I have lots of other things, and I don't always remember things, but I remember things with Swami. The other day, no, I don't know where I got a, I still play tape sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know where I got it, but sometimes people would leave things when I lived in the community, and I would pick it up. Oh, this wasn't that, but Krishna Dewey sent something through Treasures. It was mm-hmm. a concert that Swami gave, and he did the whole thing with all his music, and it was just marvelous. to hear him because it was when his voice was really wonderful singing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't get this tuning in and I can feel a presence so much, except with music, you see, I can. Mm-hmm. And when I hear him singing, and I have a couple other things, then I can really tune in to him, especially then. Or even a talk, too, because people's voices are very... I really pay attention to how people speak. There he is, you know. His vibration is there.
You have that on an MP3 or a little pen drive?
She sent it on an MP3. You can contact her. Yeah, you didn't know about that. Huh? Well, I don't know if you get it. Yeah, it's about over an hour. It's his regular little songs, and he did the whole thing.
Yeah, he used to... You know, he taught every class. I mean, he gave a satsang every Saturday. You know, first at the beginning. Every week. I mean, he did every Sunday service. I mean, he really... Mm-hmm. He was still trying to set the energy for the village in pattern. You know, there.
So he did the whole SRW, too, didn't he?
Yeah, the whole thing. The whole SRW, every day. I mean, he did the class from 10 to 12, and all of that stuff. It was remarkable. Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes, or a couple of other, because it just got me in that space.
Okay.
Some of the sweet things. Swami was in Italy. He was going to give a significant talk in Milan. And we had the blessing, we went with him. So it was Ananda Kirtani, the heads of the Italy Center, and Lakshman and Leela, and Miriam, of course, his nurse, and me and Karen. So we went up and we did the weekend. We're coming back on the train, and it's a long trip. I mean, it's like going from Northern California to L.A. You know, it's a long trip. So we're in the common cars together, and it was just us. We had a section for the Ananda people, which was nice. And it's late, and we're all wasted, and we've had a huge meal on the train. And Swami looks up with his grin on his face, and he says, "Who wants to have a pizza when we get to Assisi?" Mm-hmm. And we're all thinking, "Are you kidding?" You know, each person I could see is thinking, "I'm exhausted and I'm so full, my eyes are bubbling," you know? And no one says anything, and Swami's kind of, you know, this is like the tape recorder story. 2 minutes later, "Doesn't someone want a pizza?" Mm-hmm. And so I got it. I mean, I've been through this before, and I said, "I would love a pizza, sir." And he said, "Great." So we took everybody out for pizza. And it was so, he didn't need a pizza. I don't think he ate. It was just, he needed a format for being with people. People probably know he used to tell Woodhouse stories. Part of the reason he told the Woodhouse stories was because it was a way to engage everyone. Otherwise, what would happen is he would sit there in the dome, and everybody would just stare at him. and he, you know, and then he'd chat with the person sitting in front and say something. Everyone was straight to listen, and all he said was, "I like your sweater." I mean, it was so awkward, you know. But you wanted to hear so he just wound up reading Woodhouse stories because everybody enjoyed it. It was a way to share his energy without him being on the spot, so to speak. So, you know, things like that with pizza. One time, and it was just to give me energy. I mean, it had to be. He was working on some book. This was not so long ago, so it wasn't the crisis book. But he was working on some book, and he wanted to make reference to Hegel, the German philosopher. Mm. Hegel is very dense. Now, I'd spent time studying Hegel because I majored in philosophy. Swami called me, and he actually just rang the phone, and he said, "Karen has advice. Is David there?" "Yes, sir." Puts him in the camera. It's Swami. I'm thinking, "Oh, my God." He says, "I have a question about Hegel." And I'm thinking, "Why are you calling me? Just find out. Get on the internet or something." I mean, it had nothing to do with it. So I stammered some answer. And it was probably a reasonable answer. He said, "Thank you so much. That's so helpful." Click. I mean, come on. Anyway, so you know, he was always looking for ways to share energy with people, but he needed a context. You know, we'd watch movies with him sometimes and things. It wasn't for the movie. He just wanted to share energy, and he needed a context to have it not be awkward. So that was what was going on. And so everything was just to try and remain as open as possible in his presence. Anyway.
He's doing it right now.
He's doing it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely
right.
It's
right.
It's harder for me. You know, it's just different. Harder is not even quite the right word, but it's different.
It's different.
It is different. Somehow, You know, I do the best I can. Well, Swami himself said, you know, books can't argue back with you. You know, it's just different being able to have an exchange. But all the more all the more reason that we really need to tune in. You know, we get what we need. I mean, people at the village sometimes would feel, oh, I wish I'd been there with Master. And Swami always made the point, you get what you get because God knows what you need. And I would go through these little periods, oh, I wish I'd, but we get what we get. Master's pretty smart. He knows what he's doing.
I want to add something.
Sure.
While I think about it, I like to reread books because I don't remember as much, and it's fun anyway. So another way I tuned into Swami recently was I reread A Place Called Ananda.
Mm.
And I guess it wouldn't make any difference if it would be that book. But his consciousness seemed to come out of that so much. And it really helps me a lot. The way he wrote, I mean, he was magnificent at writing.
Yeah.
It just was wonderful. So I don't get visions and things like that. But I think I can tune in somewhere. That's really helpful for me.
Wonderful.
Well, I'm singing in the choir. I always like to say that too. But that's true. I mean, boy, that really does it. You know. So he gives us a lot of different ways we can tune in still.
Yeah.
He really does.
Well, let's sit for a minute.
Yeah.
And really try and, you know, feel that presence. Just for a minute or two.
Oh, that was nice.
Thank you very much. That was so much fun.
Really incredible blessing for me. So I really appreciate it.